Welcome back to the Haven Homestead Podcast, where we learn and grow together on our way to living more sustainable lives. My name is Chris, and this is episode 28. Today we're going to be listening to an interview, actually, that Lindsay and I were interviewed by Diego Footer from Permaculture Voices. Now, Diego, a little while ago, a few years ago, set up a conference called Permaculture Voices, where people could go and listen to permaculture experts throughout the world, and they all went to California and had this big gathering, and we weren't able to go to it, but it was a really neat event, and I've heard lots of good things about it since then. Diego kind of sent a word out that he was looking for anybody who was trying to live a sustainable life, or had permaculture type farms, or sort of things like that, that he was looking for people to interview. And so Lindsay sent him an email and told him about what we're doing. And so he interviewed us about our homestead and homestead businesses and stuff like that. That is what today's episode is going to be all about. The episode is about an hour long. At the end of it, I will give my 2 cents, and then we'll call it a day. So enjoy.
Welcome to Creative Destruction and the Voices of Change. I'm your host, Diego, D-I-E-G-O. When it comes to homesteading, there's something about it that just attracts people. The idea of living on the land and off the land, building your own house, raising your own food, all of that has a magnetic draw that pulls people in. Some people just love the idea of it. But typically this dreaming only focuses on the hard skills that go along with homesteading. Gardening, raising livestock, woodcraft, beekeeping, solar power, etc. That stuff's all well and good. But the problem is that it's only one part of homesteading. And really, that's the easy part. The hard part of homesteading is making life work under the umbrella of homesteading. Think generating a sustainable income source, saving for the future, and managing the homestead with the kids. Those are all the practical realities that often get overshadowed by the fun things that you can do on the homestead. Today we'll leave the fun things behind and talk about the practical realities of homesteading. To do that, I'm joined by a couple doing it, husband and wife, Chris and Lindsay Hodge. In 2013, they transitioned from a 1,500-square-foot house in a neighborhood in Idaho to 4.5 vacant acres in Washington. The property was raw land, and they moved there with 2 kids, living in a camper. But despite what might seem like a challenging set of circumstances, they made it work and have enjoyed the journey along the way. Let's jump right into the conversation with Chris and Lindsay to find out how they made it work and why it's worked so well. Before you all bought land and you were homesteading, what were you doing?
Chris was in the military, and we were living in Pocatello, Idaho. How big was the house, Chris?
1,500, I think, square feet.
It was built in, 1920s. We were just hanging out. It's got a small patch postage stamp yard. And when Chris and I got married, he had already been into the homesteading, sustainable living sort of lifestyle. And he brought me into it.
when he brought you into it, what was your first reaction to that? Were you receptive? Were you reluctant? Is this something you were attracted to? Did you grow up with this stuff or not at all?
So my dad is in the military, and we didn't have a garden until after I'd already graduated and left the home, graduated from high school and left home. So we always lived in cities. We always had backyards that we really couldn't have gardens in and things like that. But I've always admired that lifestyle. Like, even as a kid, I thought it would be so cool to grow up in the country or to live in the country and have a horse or some of the more glamorous things. I wasn't prepared for some of the less glamorous sides of this lifestyle, but, you know, like chickens pooping in your shoes, like, I wasn't really prepared for that, but I was pretty receptive, I think, because I've always wanted that sort of lifestyle. And I'm kind of a hippie. My dad always calls me a tree hugger and things like that. So it was interesting. And at first I was maybe a little reluctant because it's been a complete paradigm shift for me from kind of a lazy city life, where my dad used to call me Sleepy Bee, which is short for Sleeping Beauty. He named all of his, gave us all, you know, Disney princess nicknames. To being just recently, yesterday even, my dad said, I'm like a shark. If I stop moving, I'll die. And it's just been a complete paradigm shift for me. And I really enjoy the lifestyle that we lead. I love it.
So you've grown to love it, and Chris pulled you into it willingly and a little bit of nervousness coming into it. And Chris, for you, I mean, what was the draw that initially got you into this, if you go back even before this time?
That's kind of a lifelong thing, I suppose. When I grew up, so we lived in a little place called Raft River, Idaho, and our nearest neighbor was a mile away, and that was my cousin, our cousins, aunt and uncle and their kids. And so we were way out in the country. We had chickens, we had pigs, we had, you know, some calves sometimes, some steers. So I grew up always doing country living sort of stuff. And then I wanted to be a mountain man when I was young, and I realized that wasn't a really good vocational choice. So I decided to be a soldier, and you know, one thing led to another, and I was in Iraq, and I did a nighttime job, a night shift job, and I was able to be on the computer quite a bit. That was kind of part of my job criteria. And I was researching stuff in homesteading. And before that, before I had gone on that deployment, I was also in college looking up, you know, like articles that stated things like how to cut the umbilical cord, or how to, you know, plants for healing, or plants for that can grow in my climate, you know, and just things like that. I would research a lot. And when I came back from that deployment, then I told Lindsay that it would, you know, I was like, I think that we should make the move and get out of, you know, try to find a place that we like. So we were talking about Oregon and Washington. We really like this side of the country because of how green it is. And we decided that, you know, we found some land that was really reasonable priced. And it's been a learning, you know, I research all the time. I mean, multiple different things during the week am I studying and learning about, still learning about homesteading and permaculture and just growing with the task that we have set about doing.
When you initially made that move, going from the 1,500 square foot house and the postage stamp size lot to get into homesteading, I think a lot of people find themselves in this position of wanting to do this. What was the goal? If you say we're going to go homesteading, that can mean a lot of things. As it was in your mind's eye at the time, what did you envision?
Well, I think that we kind of planned more open. Right now, like, so we have 4.5 acres, and it's mostly trees and, you know, scrub trees and then big trees like Doug fir and red alder and stuff like that. But I kind of imagined more of a, you know, open a book of some sort of country farm, and there's always fields and, you know, gently rolling hills and things like that. So it wasn't quite as picturesque. We came out here to this bare property, had nothing on it. I mean, you know, no, improvements, so to speak.
Vacant land.
Yeah, it was just vacant land. So we drilled the well, we put the power in, or, you know, we had them done. We had the well drilled and the power put in and the septic installed. And, so it was kind of, but our initial goal was we wanted to do, a bed and breakfast in between Seattle and Portland, and also permaculture classes and workshops. And that was our goal. And we wanted, so we found a place near Centralia, Washington, which is right between Seattle and Portland. So we were able to, find a, it really was in a good spot. And we're up on a hill, so we're not in a flood zone just kind of everything worked out well. We had a goal, and everything worked out better than we had planned.
Yeah, I think that our planning and our goal setting process, we thought, okay, so what is our long term goal? Like 15, 20 years down the road, we want to be on a farm, growing our own food, and living off the grid. I think that was our big picture, like 15 years down the road. And in order to make that happen, you know, living off of our farm, we had to come up with some different ideas on how to make that work. And so, as Chris said, our goal was our business, our farm business, was going to be based around the bed and breakfast and workshops and classes, teaching people how to live sustainably. And so that was our long-term goal. And we when we made the change, it was kind of a sudden situation. We had purchased the land in May 2012, and we'd been out there once. I was 6 months pregnant when we came out here to chop down some trees and do some trailblazing. And then I think it was February 2013. Is that right, Chris? February 2013? He had just gotten a new job. He'd been working there 2 or 3 months, and they had an opening, which would be an increase in pay and status, and but moving to our land. And so, and he had to decide within 2 weeks of that notification whether or not we would be moving out to the land. So our initial plans that we had thought, you know, he would go to PA school and then we would move out here and live off the land. And we're thinking we'd get to the land in a couple of years. And all of a sudden we're faced with, we've got 2 weeks to decide, are we going out to the land now or are we going to hang out here? We are religious, and so we prayed about it, and we both felt like we would be happy either way. And so we said, let's just do it. Let's jump both feet into this, and let's do it. So then we started thinking about, okay, where are we going to live? Because the land doesn't have a house on it. The land didn't have a house on it. How are we going to afford living in Washington? Going from Idaho to Washington, there's a really big difference in the cost of living. And so like we had to really think about how we were going to make that work. So we decided we were going to ask his grandparents for their camper, and we would live in their camper in an RV park until we could get some facilities or something out of the land. I wanted at least water that we could access from our own land. And so that's what we did. We came out here, or we went out to Washington. We lived in the camper in an RV park for a few weeks. It ended up being, I think, like 6 or 8 weeks. And then we got the well drilled, and that was a fiasco, but, it worked out to where we moved onto our land in July of 2013, and we've been there ever since.
At the time, Chris, were you still active military or in the reserves or anything like that?
I had just gotten out, and it was a National Guard. So my, my all of my time was reserves. I did 8 years reserves and 5 years guard. And so, yeah, I got out in right around that time.
When you guys moved from Idaho to Washington, I mean, anytime you're moving that big of a step, there's job transition. What was your step initially to bridge that income gap? You said longer term, the vision was the educational center, I'll call it that. And you had, you know, the infrastructure there with the RV that was going to get you by on low expenses. But did you have a plan of, we're going to try and do this all minimalistic with the savings we had? Or did you require off-farm income at that time?
Well, I was still working for the company that I worked for in Idaho. They transferred out here, and I had applied for a position and got it. I'd only worked for this company. It was a medical supply company. I'd only worked there for since December, I think it was, of 2012. Mm-hmm. And so it was like less than 90 days that I had worked for this company, and then they had this job opening out here, and it was half an hour from our property, so we jumped on that, and so I was able to keep working there while we were cutting down trees on the weekends and developing this land. So, yeah, I had that, and it was really financially wise, I think, that how we did it, because we were able to save a lot of money without mortgage, and because there wasn't a structure like a house on the land yet, it was cheap.
The property taxes were really cheap. So you'd asked, how did we do it financially, and did we feel like we needed off-farm income? We didn't really have any farm income at that point. We started off with no farm income, and we were both working off the land. He was working at his job, and I was working for the paper. I didn't make very much money, but it made just enough extra. And so it was both of us working off-farm for the first probably 6 months to a year. And then I got some freelance writing jobs. We both feel like it was important for me to be home with our kids. We have two children, and they're pretty young. Right now they're 6 and 5. And so we felt like it was important for me to be home with them. And so my work has always been just a little bit extra on top of whatever Chris has made. And then he's had to get another job since then that was better paying and things like that. But we're always stepping towards our end goal. Whatever we're doing, if we're looking for another job, we're looking for something that makes our end goal closer. So when Chris started working at this new company, he drives a concrete mixer now. In the winter times, it's a bit slow, which is a little bit hard financially, but it pushes us towards getting our homestead more financially feasible. So that's every time we change jobs or every time we think about our finances or financial future, we always keep our end goal in mind, and we keep trying to go back to that and go towards that.
Yep, I was just offered a job somewhere else, but along the same lines of industry, but I think I'd be working more, you know, more hours throughout the year, and that really doesn't translate into what we want to do in the end, you know, as getting away from the outside work and doing more, you know, having our homestead be the main provider. So I don't think I'll be taking that other opportunity, because it's not getting us towards our goal. Even though I may be able to, at the end of the year, make more money, I think that it won't serve us what we need it to do. So
when you're in a situation like that and starting out on a fresh piece of land that's brand new, how do you allocate the income that you have coming in? Like, you initially have to pay, well, you're always going to have to pay the bills you have to pay. And then you have the surplus. And knowing that you had this longer-term goal of potentially making it a destination, doing education on the property, while also having to do all the initial build-out of the property, how did you guys approach taking the money that you had and allocating it wisely?
I think we're a little one-track-minded when it comes to that, Diego. We really like our farm. So anytime we have any extra money, which really doesn't happen when you have a young family, but anytime you have a little bit extra, we think, okay, let's go buy some fencing. Or Chris just built me a clothesline so that we can reduce our energy bill. And so anytime we have a little bit extra, we think of what little project can we do this month, and how much is it going to cost, and can we afford it this month, or should we wait until next month? But we're always really, I think we're a little one-track minded, because we're always thinking of how can we put money into our farm. And we do save money. We have to save money for the winter months, and we have to save money for the end goal. But we just keep our mind on our farm, and anything extra that we spend, we put towards the farm. And I think that's just the way we do it.
It's easy to get distracted, that's for sure. You know, oh well, I could do this now, or you know, buy this now, or you know, whatever the thing is. But yeah, you really have to stay goal focused on, well, will that get us? Will that push back our goal of total, you know, financial sustainability here on the farm another year, or will that push it back another 2 years, you know, if we do this other thing? So we have to really keep the goal in mind.
Well, thinking of your goal and thinking of how you've approached it, what's been your method of attack for moving this property forward to spending that money in the best possible way? Because as I'm hearing, like you're saying, you can get scatterbrained. You can just want to do everything. And you can also fast track towards one specific goal at the expense of everything else. How did you prioritize, you know, we do have extra money, but we're going to do A over B?
I think we talk about it a lot. We sit down and usually, I think it's usually me. I say, Chris, I'm getting overwhelmed. We have so many projects. What are we going to focus on first? And we have a conversation, and we talk about how much the different projects are. Usually we have about 15 or 20 ideas on things we could spend money on to make the farm or a goal come closer to being a reality. Usually we have a conversation about how much each one costs, what the time and effort that we'll have to put into each one is, how much time, effort, and money we have. When I say effort, I mean like energy levels. You know, sometimes when you're working 60 or 80 hours a week, you have just no energy to do anything else. So there's a lot of projects on the farm. Chris works a lot of hours in the summer, and there's a lot of projects on the farm that he just doesn't have the energy to go out and dig fence posts or things like that, because he works a lot. So we save those for when we have the energy and the time and the money to do those things.
Can you think of something that you've done or bought that's really been a leverage point to help you get ahead a lot further?
The tractor, probably. It was something that met somebody, and I told them I was looking for a tractor, and they said they had a tractor that they wanted to get rid of, and so we picked it up for a really reasonable price, and we've used it tons on, you know, keeping the driveway decent, and I need to get some more implements to help us with our goals, like a brush hog, for instance, because our goat died, and so now we don't have a brush eater, so I'm going to have to do it all manually. like Seth Holzer said, if you don't do the job of if you don't have pigs to do the job, then you have to do it yourself. So,
and I would have said that Chris's podcast that he started this year is one of the things that we've done that's really leveraged us further towards our goal. So something we've done and something we've bought, those two things. With the podcast, before the podcast, I really felt like it was just me working on our content for the website, and now that Chris has started his podcast, it's both of us are working on the content for the website, and he's got his podcast going, he's got some followers and some supporters, and I feel like that's moving us towards our goal too, a lot faster than otherwise.
What about on the flip side, where you've made a misstep and spent money where you shouldn't have? If you had a do-over, you wouldn't have done that.
I think we have a lot of those.
Well, I think I would have gone with a different company to drill our well, maybe.
Yeah, definitely.
Or, I mean, there's some things you're like, oh, man, we tried to save money, and that really ended up costing us more in the long run because we were trying to go the cheap route. You know, we try to get a lot of recycled materials, but sometimes they might not be the greatest quality, or they're wet or something, and you bring them in, and then they start shrinking because they're drying out, you know, and you don't know where they came from. I don't know. There's lots of things that we could have done different, but I think overall we're pleased as can be with where we're at and where we started.
Oh, yeah. I think right now my thoughts about where we made a misstep, not necessarily a misstep, but where we're moving on to something else that's going to be more profitable, I feel like our ducks. We got some ducks, and we love ducks, and we love our ducks. But I feel like we spend more money on them than they make us. We had too many ducks at first, and none of them were laying. And so this whole winter we fed them and we didn't get any eggs. And then this spring they started laying and we thought, oh, yay, we'll start getting more eggs. And we maybe got like 5 dozen eggs out of them. And we're getting an egg or two a day now. But just recently we had a predator come and eat half of our flock. And so I don't know. I feel like the ducks might not survive the year on our farm, but we'll see. We'll see. Maybe we'll make a change and they'll endure.
I tell you, there's hardly anything cuter than a baby duck.
That's true.
But that's, you know, and the eggs are, you know, infrequent. And so, I don't know, we've been having to make some tough decisions, I think, with those.
Because we love the ducks, but they're just not making our farm work. They're not moving us towards the end goal.
Sure. You know, you mentioned the well and driller. What advice would you give to somebody when you're approaching a driller, or thoughts to think about when you need to drill a well based on your experience?
Don't go cheap.
Yeah, and I'd say go with the good reputation, you know, the best.
Yes.
The people who have the best reputation, the signs you see everywhere. If you're driving around and they say so-and-so well drilling or so-and-so, you know, waterworks or whatever, probably go with that person because they're known in the county and they have a reputation to uphold. Whereas the ones we went with, they went out of business not long after and it cost us about double what they said it was going to cost.
We went cheap and it didn't work out.
And thinking of needing to drill a well on the property, not having water is one thing that might scare some people off. Besides location of where it was central between Portland and Seattle, why that property? What did you like about that specific piece of land versus, say, others in a 50-mile radius?
So one thing, I wrote a list of like 15 attributes or something that I wanted on land. And when we were looking for land, we told our real estate agent, we went through a few different real estate companies too, and because we wanted to spend less than $50,000, which I know, depending on where you live, that's like unheard of, but we wanted to spend less than $50,000, and there were a lot of real estate companies that never returned our calls because it wasn't worth it. They didn't get, you know, the agent wouldn't get enough
commission,
so that they decided that they, you know, it wasn't worth their time. But we found a real estate agent here that was just super nice and took us out to different properties, but we gave her a list. We said we want properties under $50,000.
Around
5 acres, right. So we brought her a list of ones that we were looking at, and she said, well, I know this one's, you know, in a floodplain, and this one is this and that, and she had some of the, she goes, this property is, let's go check that out. You know, it looks like a good idea. So we came out here to look at it and walked the property. You know, a lot of people, it's amazing that they will buy a property without actually walking around it. So we kind of trudged through the blackberries and brush and went around the property and checked it out, and it's got a creek. Well, I made these 15 a list, and I think this podcast, on my podcast, I kind of went over our land. You know, we picked it, we want to have good soil, have a, you know, a not too far down the aquifer, so we don't have to drill too far. You know, and all these pieces, we wanted to be out of the floodplain, we wanted to have running water, we wanted to have lots of trees. These are all things that we wanted to have on the property, and as I go through, I wrote down what it has as to what we wanted, and I think the one of the only things that we couldn't get out of it was we can't have a basement here, because of how high the water gets in the winter. So I think that's the only thing out of all the things we wanted. We wanted 5 acres and it's 4.5 acres. We want it to be accessible and it's right on a county road. You know, just, you need to know what you want before I think you go to look. And if there's too many things that it doesn't have, then don't get that land. You know, there's lots of land, lots of places, other places you can look.
You know, you mentioned 5 acres. I think for a lot of people, it's go big or it's not home. Why did you go with 5 acres? What was it about that size that you thought was attractive for where you guys wanted to go?
I know Lindsay's parents live on 1 acre, and that has more than enough area for, you know, to raise rabbits and raise chickens and have a really decent sized garden and things like that. I knew that an acre would be plenty, but I felt that more than 10 acres would be, especially if it's wooded and stuff, would just be too much to maintain, and plus the property taxes go up the bigger the property. So I thought, you know, 5 acres seems like a nice size. And really 4.5 acres, because of how many trees, it's more than enough to deal with.
I felt like when we were picking our land out that we really were wise in thinking about how much we could handle and how much we wanted to handle. When you think about having 180 acres, you know, or something like that, something bigger than 5 or 10 acres, you really have to start thinking about what amount of investment you're putting into it time-wise, because it does take a lot of time. And where we were just getting started, we were thinking, you know, we just want to make sure we don't bite off more than we can chew. And we thought 5 acres should be good.
So given that, you know, moving onto the land with a 10-month-old, a 2-year-old, you're living in a camper, you have to drill a well. What was that experience like for you, Lindsay, as a mom?
It was a little bit harrowing, to be honest. It was exciting. I was up for the adventure and totally there willingly. But I kept seeing the sharp implements. Like we had brush hogged some of the brush, and so there were these sticks sticking up out of the ground and on all of the paths. And so I kept seeing those everywhere. And it's that whole like horror movie dagger sound, like every time I looked at, and my kids would go out walking and they weren't steady, especially the 10-month-old. He wasn't quite walking yet. My fears were not unfounded. About 6 months or so after we moved onto the property, maybe almost a full year, Liam, my son, fell and got punctured with a stick in the face. And you know, if it had been 2 inches higher, he would have lost his eyeball, but that's just me being dramatic.
It got him in the cheek, though, so now he has a dimple that's really cute.
It is. It totally worked out perfectly. So it was a little bit harrowing, but I remember this one time when Chris and I were walking through the forest with the kids. I had this big pushing jogging stroller, had the big wheels so it could do the whole all-terrain thing. And I remember he was kind of dragging Emma along, our daughter Emma. She's the oldest, and she had tripped and fallen and was crying, and Chris kind of started, "Why aren't you having fun? This is supposed to be fun," I said. And I remember saying to Chris, "This is hard. We have to make it fun. So instead of yelling, let's," he wasn't necessarily yelling at her. He was just kind of getting frustrated that she was having a hard time. But and that's totally understandable. But I remember thinking, we really have to make this fun. It has to be, we have to have the attitude that this is fun, and we have to treat it like it's that. Even if people are having a hard time, you can put on a positive attitude and see the silver lining, and instead of, you know, shouting at her for tripping and crying, you know, pick her up and say, and distract her with, oh, look, there's a birdie over there, or, you know, things like that. So it was definitely an attitude mindset thing that made the terror okay. And then it was hard living in the camper because I have allergies, and I felt like no matter where I went, inside or outside, I was always feeling sick. But again, I just had to put a positive attitude on it, and Chris was very supportive and helpful, and we really did. We made it through. We really did it. I think we did it well.
And if you think back to that first year, Chris, what was your thoughts then, having actualized this dream that you'd had? You'd gone from the house to now on a homestead. You'd researched it forever. Now you're actually there doing it in the thick of it, two kids. How are you liking life at that time?
I was in seventh heaven. I feel like ever since we moved out here, there's been, you know, little dips, but other than that, it feels like I've always been on cloud nine. So I love it. I love the woods. I love the homesteading lifestyle. I love going out and seeing the sun and the trees and the animals making their noises. And I love it.
And thinking of you guys living in a camper that first year, how was the winter? My thought is, kids in that contained space, how do you not go nuts?
So I had Chris build me a porch. So there was a front porch that was covered. So we could go out and play on the front porch if we were getting too cooped up and we didn't want to run to town. We read books. We watched probably way too much TV. The first winter, all of the walls were wet, something that anybody going to live in a camper needs to understand is that because of the lack of insulation, there you'll get condensation in your walls, on your walls. Everything will be wet. After the first winter, the second winter, we got a dehumidifier, and it made a huge difference on everyone.
But we're also using propane heat, too.
Right. So we were using the wet heat, plus we didn't have a dehumidifier. And so the second winter was definitely a lot better once we got the dehumidifier in there. And anytime the walls or the windows started to get a little foggy, we'd flip on the dehumidifier and everything would be better. The first winter, we went to the library a lot. I spent a lot of time out of the house. I probably spent 5 out of the 7 days of the week not in our house. Not in the camper, rather, because it wasn't a house, it was a camper. but by the second winter, I was probably spending 3 days out of the house a week instead of 5. I measure the ability to stay in the house and keep the kids wrangled and all that stuff in days of the week. And so now that we have the house, we probably spend 6 of the 7 days in the house, unless it's a busy week. But so we spend maybe one or two days of the week out of the house now that we have a house.
And what was the tipping point decision to go from camper to house? Why did you do it when you did it? Was it a space issue? Was it you had the funds available at the time? Were you over the camper?
I think there was a combination of all those things. The camper really wasn't that bad. You know, a lot of people that come by, they said, wow, you're so amazing. I know Lindsay got a lot of accolades from her friends saying, wow, it's amazing how that you can handle this. And it must be so hard raising a family in here. And I don't know. I didn't really mind it so much, but we were kind of over the camper, and Liam kept asking if we could go camping, and we're like, we are camping. we live camping. So and it was just kind of that time when we're like, you know, we need to just build a house. So we had gotten the bids back, and that seemed to take a long time, and then we got the authorization from the bank, and that seemed to take a long time. And then we finally were able to start construction in like May of last year, and that was really exciting to have the guy come out. And it took me weeks to cut the trees down and drag them off and cut them up and all the stuff that we had to do to clear the land. The guy comes out with his bulldozer and pops all the stumps, plus clears all the land for the septic area and all that in like 2 hours. And that's when I decided I need a bulldozer, but Lindsay still hasn't let me get one.
We'd also been working really hard to get ourselves into a financial position to afford a home loan, a mortgage. With one household income, it's a struggle nowadays to get a loan for anything because there's only one income. There's not as much security. And so we worked really hard over the 3 years that we were in the camper to pay down debt and to get into a position where we could afford a mortgage payment. That was a challenge, but we did it.
In the debt that you paid down, if you don't mind asking, was that student loan debt, credit card? A lot of people face those challenges. I hear them all the time as big stumbling blocks. Are people looking to go the farming lifestyle?
Well, the biggest chunk of money was that we paid down was our land, our property loan. And we got that paid off before we built the house. And so our land was our down payment when we got the loan to build.
Because we owned it at that point. We had the title in hand. So.
Right. So the money that, you know, the value of the land was the down payment. So we didn't have to save up the down payment. So that was the biggest thing. Other than that, we did pay down a lot of credit card debt. We still have some student loans, but they were such minor – it's such a minor payment, our student loans, that it didn't require our attention immediately. So that's something that we're still working on. But
and it's not top priority because it's only a few thousand dollars is all that's left. So we don't really have – it's not weighing heavily on us. Like,
and the interest rate is reasonable. And so that's not our priority. Our priority is the higher interest credit card and now our home mortgage. Those are going to be our high priorities for debt payment, debt repayment.
You know, over those first few years being on the property, say up until house building time, do you feel like it progressed as planned? Did things go slower than you expected? Did you think you'd be further ahead at that time?
I think it went right as planned. When we were planning on living in the camper, when it was that February 2013, we had 2 weeks to make the decision to go or stay. The initial plan was to be in the camper for 3 to 5 years. And after about 6 months being in the camper, I thought, no, we need to be out of here in a year. but then I calmed down and, you know, Chris talked me down we stuck it out for our original 3 to 5 year plan of being in the camper. We were in there for 3 years, 3.5 almost.
Oh, you were asking, did it take longer, just for people out there, that if you're going to build a house, know that when the drywall's going in, you're only about 50% done. It feels like you're just about ready to move in when the drywall's going in, but there is still a ton of stuff to do. And that's one thing that I think I was surprised at.
I think one of the biggest pieces of advice that everyone gave us while we were building was that it will always cost more money and take twice as long as you plan on it. I think that's just par for the course. It building the house, I think, took a little longer than we wanted to, and there were times when I was like, get me into my house already. But a little bit of patience goes a long way. It really makes the whole experience more enjoyable. And if you're not fighting time, if you're letting time kind of work for you and you think you give yourself reasonable time frames, then there shouldn't be a problem. You shouldn't feel like it's taking forever.
And knowing that you're there now for a few years into this, you're in the house now, so you've lived the lifestyle. How have you started to evolve income production off of the property
over time. If you go back to day one, maybe initial ideas, thoughts you had, stuff you tried, and then stuff you scrapped, how is it evolving towards where it is today?
That first winter we talked about was a little bit difficult. Chris was working probably 60 hours a week. Chris has this incredible skill, talent, natural gift. I'm not sure what it is. But he talks to people and they give him things.
It's that I look homeless, so they take pity on me and like, here, you need this?
You do not look homeless. So that first winter, Chris acquired a lot of tools. He also sold a lot of cutting boards. He started making cutting boards, and we started selling them to just people that he saw with his day job. There were a lot of old ladies and a lot of people that were willing to spend $60 on a really nice cutting board. And so that first winter, Chris started making woodcrafty things. And we started selling them on Etsy. And then he had a friend, a neighbor, ask him if he could copy this wooden spatula thing. It's called a spurtle. And it, what was the company that originally made it, Chris?
I think it was a Galloping Gourmet.
Yeah, so it was a Galloping Gourmet spurtle. And hers was getting old, and she wanted a new one. And she said, well, Chris, will you make some out of this wood that I have here? And he said, yeah, of course I can do it, because that's another talent Chris has. You ask him to do something, and he's always right on top of trying something new and being excited about it. He got into making some pallet furniture and pallet cabinets and things like that. And so he really got into the woodworking for a little while, but he still works outside of the farm, and so he doesn't have as much time to spend on that as he'd like. And we put a bunch of things up in our Etsy store, thinking that might work to earn us a little bit of income. And it has, but it's not really been a lot. It's usually we get two or maybe three orders a month until recently. That's kind of evolving into Chris's podcast. So we also taught classes. We started teaching classes in, I think it was 2014, through our local community college. They have a continuing education program where folks from the community can teach classes and get paid to do it. And the university or the college takes like a 30% fee or something like that on the class fee. So you get 20 people out to your class and, you know, you get paid to do it. You don't have to have a college degree or anything to do that. You just have to be an expert in the field that you're trying to teach a class in. So we started teaching classes that way, and we did it all the way up until we started building the house. And then I said, Chris, I can't have you sacrifice any of your Saturdays for that. We're going to take a break from teaching classes. We kind of started up again this summer, but we didn't really have we only had one person sign up for our classes this spring. So I think it'll just be another slow ball moving forward that, you know, we'll get more people to our classes.
Our very first class only had two people show up.
Right.
And then the next class had like four, and then after a while, we got to where we were full, and the college would send out a mailer to everyone in the county, and that's how people found out about our classes. Well, they didn't send out a mailer this last cycle, so no one knew that we were having classes, and I think that's what really impacted our numbers, because people were still interested, but it's just that they didn't know when the classes were or that we were even offering them.
Right. So we're gonna do more classes again in the fall. That's something that we really enjoy doing, and it's easy to do, and it feels financially feasible because we don't spend a lot on setting up the class and we get paid for it. So we'll definitely keep doing that. So we still have our Etsy store, but since I'm not home right now, I'm on vacation. We kind of paused all of our Etsy listings so that Chris wasn't overwhelmed with running our Airbnb, which is new this year. all of the decisions that we make, we try to make sure that we're not biting off more than we can chew. And everything just kind of evolves. We pick the thing that works and kind of let go of the thing that's not working. For example, with I'm a writer and a photographer, and when we moved here, I started working for the newspaper, but it started to take up too much of my time, and I was becoming a yelly mom, the kind of mom that yells at her kids for no good reason, and I didn't like that. So I shifted and I became a freelance writer, and then that started taking up too much time with not enough return. And so then I stopped that, and I started kind of self-publishing my own books. I've been learning about self-publishing and all the things that goes with it. That way I can really manage my time and spend more time on the family and the farm than I do working, and still get a return for it. And I just recently published my first adult nonfiction. Bravo! It's How to DIY Anything, The Ultimate Maker Mindset. And so it's all about thinking like a successful DIYer in order to be a successful DIYer. And that's just kind of how we progress. We start one thing, we think, oh, well, that's working, or maybe that's not, and then we keep moving forward and just decide what's working and what's not, and let go of the things that aren't and embrace the things that are.
In the email that you sent me, you said it's been a every drop in the bucket counts thing. You know, the approach, seeing this, reading the email, is it's a basket. You're doing a bunch of different things that all put dollars into the basket. There's two ways that I guess you could cash flow a homestead. I mean, one is this basket approach. The other is we're going to find this thing and go all in on this thing and thinking this thing could scale. Maybe that's a livestock enterprise. If you all just decided this approach because this is what works for you guys, it fits your personalities. I don't think there's a right or wrong approach, but I think people sometimes get fixated on we have to do just this one thing, where you guys clearly have, we're going to try a bunch of different things, including this off-farm income. Are you okay with that approach? Is that the approach you sought out? And why haven't you gone for, say, one of like, we'll just raise chickens or ducks or rabbits?
I think you got to do what you like to do the best, and it makes you money. So you have to weigh what kind of thing. If you really like cows, then maybe you should just raise cows, and if it makes you happy and makes you money, then you're on the right track. But I love learning and teaching. It's my thing. It's my jam. And Lindsay really likes to write and do photography. So she handles the Haven Homestead Media angle of things, other than the podcast. And then I try to disseminate information through the podcast and our classes and stuff. And then we like meeting people, so the Airbnb made sense. And we have a guest bedroom, so...
I was really afraid that guest room would become a storage room for junk. I don't like junk, so I was like, let's make this useful. I think, Diego, that this approach really does just suit our personalities. We like a lot of different things.
Well, and if you pick the ones you really like, and if they make you money, then I think you should go with it.
Yeah, see, like, I'm very much a learner like you, and like into learning a bunch of stuff, trying a bunch of stuff, and I sometimes find myself caught up and frustrated because I'll catch myself doing too much and thinking, oh, I need to refine down, because while it's great to pursue those passions, if it's 10 things putting a dollar in a bucket each versus 5 things putting $5 in a bucket each, it's more effective. I mean, that's just one thing I struggle with. So I'm curious how you guys have handled it, but hearing it, it sounds like it's worked.
Right. Well, we do struggle with that too, Diego. There are times when I felt like we've had too much going. And right now that's one of the other reasons why the Etsy is being paused, because it's just too much right now. So you have to find and strive for that balance when you're thinking about all the things you need to work on in order to earn money with your farm and to fill that bucket that income bucket that everyone needs to have filled. We've definitely had moments where we're like, we need more money. We have so many things going on. What can we do to put a razor sharp focus on something to make it more successful or things like that? I think one of the reasons why Chris and I are successful at this sort of basket approach is that we check in with each other. We talk to each other and we say, hey, this is too much. We need to figure out a different way to do this. And then we do it and we act on that plan that we've established. But I really do think that the success is in the conversation and then follow through.
Yeah, communication is definitely key with a lot of the things that you stay on the same page with both Lindsay and I, because we've got different interests and different, things on the farm. You know, our focus is on different things. Like, so we keep on, we make some woodcrafts, but I've kind of discovered that that's going to be more of a hobby than an actual vocation. And then we still get requests or, invitations to craft shows and stuff to sell our woodcrafts. But I think it takes too much time, like the $1, you know, 10 different things, is it just takes too much time and the return isn't really there. I mean, we can do okay, like on a Saturday, but all the prep work and then going there and sitting up and doing the thing and then leaving, it really doesn't translate to very much money per hour. So we have to kind of trim the fat, as it were.
The ROI is not high enough.
Lindsay, I know you got to go run here, so I just wanted to say thanks for coming on today, taking the time. I'll be sure to link to your book in the show notes. But good luck with everything. Enjoy it all and have fun with the kids.
All right. Thanks, Diego. You have a great day.
Chris, one of those big income streams that you guys have right now is Airbnb. It's an interesting model, and we've kind of kicked that idea around here at our place. What have been your thoughts on it? What's the good? What's the bad?
I think that the good has outweighed any of the bad. We've been very fortunate to have really good guests. So on the bad side is you can have people just book automatically, like, I'm not sure what it's called, but they can just book your place and then they show up and you don't have to do anything. You don't have to authorize them or anything. And you get more customers that way because they don't have to be waiting for you to confirm or to acknowledge, accept their request. But you can't filter who comes out there, because sometimes when someone will send a request, they'll have a little bit of information on them, and maybe you could look on Facebook to see, or you know, Twitter or Instagram or something, and learn about them to see that they're not a psycho. But with the automatic confirmation booking, that you can't really filter who comes out. And so potentially, and I got two little kids and things that we care about in the house. So kind of be a little nerve wracking as to if you trust them or not, because you're letting strangers into your house. So that could be the negative part. But on the upside, we've had great guests. One couple even stayed with us for a whole week and really got to know them really well. And we've had people from, different countries in Europe just international. And we have more lined up, and it's been, a good opportunity for us. And it's not really that expensive. So, people, I think, are more willing, and we live close to Mount St. Helens and Mount Rainier, so there's are both things that draw people in, and just a couple driveways down is the Seattle Firearms Academy, so people that want to learn how to handle firearms and stuff, is just, you know, they come from all over the states to that school, so that's one way we can. Something close that people can come out and see. And then there's also those that just want to come out and see the farm. And so we show them around the orchard and show them around the animals, and they can gather eggs and hold a baby rabbit and things like that. It's been a good experience, in kind of getting our name out there and making a little money on the side.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the trade-off is you're trading that security. I mean, that's our biggest worry, having kids and having somebody into your house is, while you trust people, you got to be leery.
And trust your gut. I mean, if you get a bad vibe, then, you know, we have a little fold-out bed that we can put in our bedroom so the kids can stay down with us if we, you know, get a bad vibe or something from somebody. But so far, everyone's been really awesome.
Looking back on everything, knowing that you have this diversified income approach, where do you feel like you are in relation to the future of Haven Homestead? Initially, you mentioned that you had wanted to do an education center, teach classes on site. Is the goal still pointed at that, or has it evolved over time?
Oh, no, it's still aiming for that. So in the end, our end goal, I guess, would be, is to have workshops out here, like, you know, on a regular basis, have week-long workshops where people would come out, and we'll have, so the camper that we lived in, we're going to put that up on Airbnb, because it's pretty much an apartment. And then we have another trailer that's removed from the house that will be off-grid, and we're going to make that into a tiny house so that we can have housing for these people to come out and stay for during our workshops. And, you know, it's going to be like 10 people per workshop, you know, sort of thing, so that we can give everyone individual attention, and they'll learn, you know, everything there is, maybe not everything there is to know, but the really important things in homesteading. So there'll be a few classes per day, 5 days, you know, for 5 days straight, and they'll go away with knowing how, you know, have the confidence, I think, is one of the big parts, is people, I'm sure you've heard paralysis through analysis. They learn about all this stuff, and then they're like, oh, that, you know, that seems kind of complicated, and I don't want to mess up, so I won't try. And I think that coming out here and having someone that can show you how to raise rabbits and then later how to process them would really give someone the confidence to know that they can do it. I want to help them learn how to do the homesteading sort of thing. And so the end goal, like you asked, if that's the classes and workshops, yes, that's still the goal. And I think that it's such an important thing for people to learn.
Yeah, I think when it comes to homesteading, there's this desire and big thirst out there to learn these types of skills. And some people are just curious. They want to see where food comes from. They want to have that experience just once in their life, see it, say they did it, and move on with things. And I think there's other people that want to take those skills and use them on a day-to-day basis in a similar way that you all are doing. And I think what's most interesting to me about what you all are doing is the fact that you're still doing it. I think a lot of people set out on that lifestyle and the confined space, the slow progress, the lack of money, the distance from civilization, the separation from modern inconveniences is more than most people can handle or more than most people expect going in, and they just don't last. And you started doing this basically when you bought the land back in 2012, so you're 5 years into this. It's a process, and it's a slowly evolving process. And I think the other thing people can't handle is just that it's a slow evolution. I think people want to snap their fingers, move on to a homestead, and bam, it's functioning tomorrow. But I don't think you have that story to tell.
Oh, no. But I totally know what you mean. So when I was getting ready to plant some fruit trees or looking what fruit trees I wanted to plant, you know, sort of thing. And remember, they said, you know, it won't bear fruit for 3 years. I was like, 3 years? Are you kidding me? I was like, what am I going to do for 3 years? But that time is come and gone. So it happens, you know, you just kind of let them do their thing. Keep the plants watered and you know, the trees, and you should be able to get some fruit in a few years. But it's just, I remember thinking that same, what you're talking about is just, it seemed like it'd take forever, but really it's all worth it in the end.
And when you look back on these 5 years, what have been the highlights away from the land? What's been the stuff that's made it all worth it for you?
I think that when people come out, and I don't know how many people we've had tell us, this is exactly what I want to do someday, or you know, we love your guys' lifestyle, or, oh, this is so neat. My aunt and uncle were just out 2 weeks ago, and with all their kids, and I was showing them around. They hadn't been out here yet, and I was showing them around, and my aunt, she's already a nice person, but I don't think she was just saying this for my benefit, because, you know, just to make me feel good. But she was like, this is like a tour of the most amazing places ever. And I felt good about it, but I really do think that the people coming out and seeing that this is possible and that it can be fun and enjoyable is the best part of it.
Yeah, and you're around the people you love, you're doing it. This is something it sounds like you've always wanted to do, and you found your stride, and that's a cool place to be. You do a podcast now. What do you generally try and cover on your podcast for people that might be interested?
So we just do homesteading, permaculture, sustainable living sort of podcasting, and at havenhomestead.com is where, under the podcast tab, is where you can find all of our episodes.
Okay, yeah, I'll be sure to link to that. I'll link to everything else that you guys are doing so they can check it out, stay in touch for future classes. But I want to thank you and Lindsay, who's no longer here again, for taking the time to come on today and just share your experience and what you're doing and give a realistic look at what the homesteading lifestyle is really like.
Yeah, thank you. It's been great talking to you.
There you have it, Chris and Lindsay Hodge of the Haven Homestead. I hope you enjoyed this one. A few of the big takeaways from me in this one: long-term goals, know what they are and always be working towards them. I think a lot of people go in not knowing what their long-term goals are. I think a lot of people go in with long-term goals, but if they're not achieving those long-term goals in the short term, they get frustrated and want to give up. Know what your long-term goals are, know that they're long-term, and work towards them. In a similar point, give yourself a reasonable, realistic time frame for things to play out. It's all not going to happen right away. It's going to take time. Accept that by having a realistic time frame and a realistic set of expectations for it all to play out. If you want to learn more about Lindsay, Chris, and the Haven Homestead and stay up to date with everything that they're doing, check out the show notes at permaculturevoices.com/233. There on that page, there's links to everything that they're doing, their podcast, their books, all of it. Be sure to check it out, especially if you're into this homesteading thing or you want to try it with your family. Start by listening to a family that's been there and done it. And Chris and Lindsay are people who've already done it. That's all for this one. I hope you enjoyed it, but more importantly, I hope you do something with the information in this episode. Get to work, find something that you love and fulfills you, and go for it. The journey will be hard, you'll want to quit, it'll take everything out of you, and odds are that you'll fail. I hope that you do it anyway. So go out there and do some epic you-know-what.
All right, so that was our interview with Diego Footer, and I hope you enjoyed it. It was really neat to be interviewed by somebody that people know, a name that's recognized because of the work he's done with the Permaculture Voices and that. I think that this has been, you know, just my little 2 cents after listening to the episode and after, you know, thinking about the interview and stuff. I think that this has been a somewhat rocky road, with lots of trials and tribulation, lots of thorns along the path. However, when I walk outside in the morning and the sun's coming through the leaves, and it's just beautiful. I love it so much. It's just you know, it's inspiring that I know that I'm doing what I should be doing, and I'm loving the journey. So it's all worth it. There's been hard times, but the good times definitely outweigh the hard times. And I hope that this episode has helped you know that you can do it too. And you don't have to start as big as, you know, 4.5 acres like we have. We probably only use 3/4 acre on a regular basis. You can do, you know, you can do a lot with a little if you just put your mind to it. This has been the Haven Homestead Podcast, where we learn and grow together on our way to living more sustainable lives. Thanks for listening.